there's an awful lot of news in the news, if that's possible. So we're going to get right into it. Mae Brussels to discuss and enlighten and raise questions. Mainly, you raise a lot of questions that never seem to have answers until, well, they do. A few weeks later, the answers come out.
A year later.
So there's a lot happening with the Watergate affair, as it is being called. And a lot happening with Arthur Bremer, which may also be the Watergate affair. You don't know.
James Ray.
Why don't you pick a point and start?
Okay, should we tell them what dialogue assassination is? Dialogue conspiracy?
Dialogue conspiracy, okay. Let's tell them what that is.
Well, for those who haven't been listening for a long time, for a steady year, or haven't listened before, dialogue conspiracy came on the air to explain the conspiratorial process of the United States, mainly done through assassination. I'm a research worker in political assassinations, starting with the death of John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, the Sharon Tate massacre, the Otto family massacre, the Wallace shooting. I follow political assassinations, who is affecting the course of elections, because every one of these things affects elections. Did you notice in the paper this week, Phil, there was an article that there's a pattern of prison riots at the same time that there's ghetto riots, and they happen during election years? And I said these are provocateurs. There was a very astute resume this week that there seems to be a wave of pattern that comes at certain years where prisons and ghettos and minorities riot. And many times on the show we talk about the provocateurs that are put there for electoral purposes, like Adolf Hitler did, to get law and order. And I sent a letter to various gentlemen up at San Quentin and said, lay low. If they want you to cut your hair, cut it. Obey. Say yes, sir, because they're going to provoke a lot of riots the month of August while the Republican convention's going on. And I sort of laid out this blueprint. And this was happening about a month ago that I was talking about these riots. And there's been a rash of prison riots since that time, since that letter and message went out to them up there at the prison in San Quentin, because that's the only one where I have friends that I know of. But I would like, you know, to be able to tell all of them, don't fall for their game. Don't get worked up.
The word provocateur came up from Santa Cruz. It was mentioned in a Santa Cruz County grand jury report into the violence and the demonstration last May.
That's right.
The anti-war demonstrations, and the county grand jury, although they didn't say whether the provocateurs were organized or not.
Or hired.
They did say that it appeared that there were provocateurs involved in the...
Meaning not regular students, that's right.
People that were urging people on to violence. And
the law enforcement in Santa Cruz got mad and said, you didn't put it, the college there didn't blame the students. That, you know, the responsibility should have come down on those terrible young people today who are rioting in the streets. This is what the law enforcement officials wanted. But the decision of the grand jury was that people outside the college community were provoking situations, along with the policemen doing violent acts, and it wasn't the student body. Well, we've been on the air just 14 months, once a week, on dialogue, conspiracy, and assassination. And at that time, just as a five-second review, when the Pentagon Papers broke, I said that America had one big problem, one big belch to get out, the really big problem. The Pentagon Papers revealed that we don't tell the truth, our public officials, that deception is carried along the line. There was no real plan for the Vietnam policy. We planned the removal of Diem, just like I know we did many heads of states, including the ones in our own country. And at that time, I said conspiracies were not a popular subject at all. They weren't in the news. But this week, I brought in... It's 1 year later, and I've brought in a pile of articles, and we'll just have to skim through them, on the Sirhan case in Los Angeles, James Ray, Jim Garrison in New Orleans, and Clay Shaw, and the Watergate connected to the electoral process again. And the news is just filled with conspiracy and assassination murder cases.
While we have yet to begin on the specifics, let me bring up another article, too, because in programs past, you've mentioned Greece and the United States involvement in Greece, and now the premier, the dictator, or whatever you want to call him in Greece, has just simply asked his whole cabinet to resign. He said goodbye to them. How does that fit in with things? Have you analyzed that situation in Greece there?
Yes, I follow Greece very closely. And the story that I did, the Watergate affair that is being distributed in across the country now, that from the Realist, that we'll give you the address in a few minutes, that Paul Krasner published, mentions the relationship of Greece and the overthrow of Greece and the selection of Spyro Agnew. The reaction to the article so far, few people have read it, and it's in the hands of people. It's moving on now to the news media. Various members of the Senate and Congress will be distributed by tomorrow to a lot of them. If this article is real, then Nixon has to be impeached as well as Agnew, and that's what I want. I want the vice president running with Richard Nixon, who was selected by the Greek military junta, removed from the candidacy in the next few weeks. I brought in, and this fits in with the conspiratory aspect of it, because Agnew is a conspiracy. He was put on us by a police state. He is not a Republican as such. I don't consider him a Republican as such. And Life magazine had an editorial. Last week they came out with an editorial about not having Agnew as vice president, and they followed it up with another one, and that they didn't want him as president. The LA Times had two editorials that didn't want Agnew as vice president. And Life this week had an article by Hugh Seide on the complacencies now of the Republicans, that they're just about a shoe in it. And it goes in that the next 4 weeks, they say, will be critical ones. But it looks like Nixon has everything going for him. He's got labor and John Conley and the Texans, and he let Jimmy Hoffa out. He was paroled, and he has a Soul City going for Floyd McKissick and the Jewish support because of Israel. And then it said, unless something goes off, unlike the disaster of Culloden, that was a battle in Scotland, the McGregors this time will stand on a victorious field. That's Clark McGregor, who took over John Mitchell. His position with the committee to reelect Richard Nixon. It'll be interesting to see in the next 2 weeks what Life magazine has to say about Agnew and Nixon when some of this information comes out about Greece and Spyro Agnew. I follow the shuffling of the cabinet out there. I read today that Peru was becoming a total dictatorship with no freedom of the press. We're lining up total fascist countries against the communist bloc side by side. And as long as we're on the Watergate article, just briefly, I'm jumping around. There was an article this week in the paper that it just briefly mentioned. It didn't mention the names in the Mercury, but it mentioned on the television last week, during the week, that the accounting office, the general accounting office, and this is part related to Congress, will audit the finances of President Nixon's campaign because of possible links to the break-in at the Democratic Party headquarters. That money, there was money from Marie Stand, Secretary of the Treasury, and John Mitchell, part of the committee to reelect Richard Nixon. The money from that group, the committee, $25,000 of it that was earmarked for the president's campaign fund, was found in the pocket of Bernard Barker when he was arrested at the Watergate Hotel. And the newspaper said this is the first time that the bugging incident was related to the campaign finance law, that, you know, that they were supposed to register a certain amount of money up to a date, and the rest would be made public. And that date was April the 7th, and supposedly this money was pulled out of the bank on April 25th. So they're going to trace. This is the door open that could remove Richard Nixon and Spyro Agnew. It's right through the Watergate door. But last night was the first acceptance of the major news media on all the networks of the money related from the Republican committee to the Watergate incident and the men arrested. But I wrote an article for 3 weeks. They were arrested on June the 17th, and the article went to the printers July the 11th. And the whole thing relates them to the committee, and the news has failed to face what was happening for 1 month. This is August the 2nd, and finally on August the 1st, they say, well, there's a link. You know, nobody could figure out why John Mitchell resigned. They could have found the link, just like they could find who shot Governor Wallace. We'll go into that in a second. But they're a little slow at doing things like you say. We talk about it, and it'll come in later because we've talked about this for 3 weeks now, and it'll be coming in. There was another article on the bugging incident and Nixon's aide being linked to the Watergate Hotel, which was interesting. And this is one of the most important articles, too, to come out because a man who works, who was in charge of the committee reelect Richard Nixon, the lawyer, the head lawyer for the whole committee, telephone calls were coming to his phone from Bernard Barker from Miami. But the important thing is that Charles Colson, who is in the White House, who supposedly hired one of the men, Howard Hunt, in the White House, who the arrested men had his name on their pocket when they were arrested, Charles Colson and Al Wong is from Secret Service, and he was supposed to have hired one of the men who was arrested to be chief of security at Miami at the time of the conventions. Charles Colson and Al Wong have been given an attorney by Richard Kleindienst of the Justice Department. The Attorney General of the United States has given them an attorney, Mr. Goldblum, to represent their defense in the case, and he's prosecuting the case. The same Justice Department, the Attorney General that replaced John Mitchell, is prosecuting the Watergate affair, and he's sending the lawyers for the defense.
That's doesn't sound right.
Does it? No. Lawyers that I've spoken to just...
On what basis is he supplying the defense attorneys?
Well, what I'm trying to point out, Phil, on this program, and I try hard every week, is to say that we have a actual dictatorship that kills the opponents in an electoral year or else intended to overthrow the government this year, you know? And that when you talk about Greece, it's easy to look way over there and say, well, the premier shuffles his cabinet without any concern. That's what we do. We pull people in. We don't have any say over who our cabinet is. Nixon's had the biggest shuffle of people of any president. They walk in and walk out with no excuse. It's just like John Mitchell steps down from one job and steps out of another where he's directly linked to a criminal case here. But the Justice Department, and I've tried to say this for a long time, does not represent finding justice. We can go into this now with the Arthur Bremer case where it's so obvious how the FBI, who I know not only was in on the whole planning of the thing, but is letting Bremer go, their whole prosecution from the FBI, the main witness said Bremer didn't even hold a gun. Or no proof that he did. We'll go into that. But the point is on the Watergate story that the Justice Department, the Attorney General, is sending the lawyers to defend to the men, and he's doing the prosecuting.
Well, how does he justify, again, sending, you know, Justice Department attorneys to defend them? Is it because of their positions in the White House?
He justifies it. Well, he has to take this because it involves the White House. There's no civilian lawyer that knows the mischief the White House is into. There's no one that knows what the White House has done for the last 20 years. And there's no one in the last 10 years that I have studied that has any idea how Richard Helms of the CIA or Richard Nixon or John Mitchell run this country.
Now,
they can't send in. He says there'll be no conflict of interest. He was asked, is there a conflict of interest? He says, no, because we won't let our criminal department see what the civil department's doing. They, you know, they're just about a hair's breadth away.
Well, the military also provides both sides.
That's right.
Military cases and Billy Smith case, although Billy Smith has one civilian defense attorney.
Well, I question
that.
He has
two military defense attorneys and two military lawyers are prosecuting him.
Yeah.
So it does happen in the government.
Well, I'd have to know more about Luke McKissick because...
Luke McKissick is the attorney for...
I know. He's
civilian
what you
attorney.
Call a civilian.
I'm just trying to clarify.
I'm trying to clarify whether he's still military. You see, the men that work for the Warren Commission, the lawyers that work for all of the assassination cases, like Percy Forman or F. Lee Bailey, are military lawyers. They just wear street clothes, but they work for the military, and only the military cases.
Any proof of that?
Well, I have a documentation from lawyers in the Southwest that every trial lawyer that comes in on the assassination cases is signed from Muscle Shoals, Alabama. And I don't have the linking of McKissick to that, but I have, we'll go right into the, after we do the Wallace today, we'll go into the Sirhan, and I'll show you the kind of evidence that Luke McKissick allows Sirhan to sit on at San Quentin with you. First it was death row, now it's commuted to life in jail, where the case would be overturned. If he could have the attorney he wanted, I'm sure it could be overturned, because he's tried to get him, and they won't let McKissick off the case. And that's another way, you know, that they're assigned, because you can't fire them. They just sit there. You can't get rid of them.
About the Watergate affair, May, before we leave it completely, do you think that that the Watergate affair, the fact that the Republicans are being tied in the White House specifically, is being tied to the break-in at Democratic headquarters in Washington, D.C.? Do you think that's going to eventually have a great effect on the election? Or do you think that eventually it's going to be explained away and covered up?
Well, about four people who saw the advance copies of the Watergate affair story that I did said it. I don't like to put it in grandiose terms. Wait and see. Let's let them. Their reaction was that it was just unreal, that if this was true, of course it would affect the elections. But then I used to have a fantasy that I could stop the elections in 1972 on the basis of all information I had, that if we could get it to the people, it would be possible to have Congress halt them and examine all the candidates and get that funding out and find out if Richard Nixon is a clandestine agent and not a Republican, and if Agnew is selected by a clandestine group and not the Republican Party. See, these men don't go to any Republican meetings. They don't have to campaign on the streets. The excuse is violence, but they don't relate to the Republican Party. When Nixon wanted to decide in 67, it went to the law office in New York, and John Mitchell was at another law office, and their offices merged. And Mitchell and Nixon had a meeting, and it was decided that John Mitchell would run Nixon's campaign. And then Nixon told all the Republican governors that came to him, don't see me. I don't want to see you. You're to contact John Mitchell, you know. Well, a man who has lost for the Senate in California and who's lost for governor of California and wanted the office so badly in those years would welcome any Republican governors who wanted to see him, because this is how you run campaigns. You don't throw the Republican governors away. But he referred them all to John Mitchell. Then John Mitchell goes to Congress and to speak to about 15 Republicans in the House. And he met them, and he says, I'm John Mitchell. I'm going to manage Richard Nixon's campaign. You're going to want to see me, but you can't see me because I'll reach you, and you may not like what I'm doing. This is, in fact, what he said. But we'll get this thing on, and he'll win. And when you're ready, I'll meet with you. You won't be able to see me. That's not the way you run a campaign in the United States, if you want the high-ranking Republicans in the country.
So you don't think that the last of the Watergate affair has been heard yet?
Oh, Phil, please, let us see.
I've got to ask.
I don't know. You evidently haven't read it yet, or you wouldn't ask that question.
Well, I've been doing this show for so long, you could recite it.
No. You know, the funny thing is that we've been doing this show on...
Well, I've listened to this show, you know, and been on the show for a long time, and it's having a great effect on people in the area that the station covers.
Yeah.
I have read the article, and I happen to think... you know, personally, that the article has some incredible things to say, which if picked up by the right people, it could really knock a few people over. But, you know, the fact that the article is written and the fact that I believe that...
Doesn't mean that they will.
Right, and that's why I ask you...
Well, I have a few things going in my favor with the article, and that's this, that a lot of good books have been done about the assassination. A lot of evidence of conspiracy has been put out. But the things that I have going are several factors. In the first place, Richard Nixon said, please don't pursue the suit because it'll damage me. So he knows it's important. The second thing is that John Mitchell resigned because of the Watergate, so it's explosive. And the third thing is that Martha Mitchell is still an actual prisoner. And you get a lot of women's lib or human interest people wondering what really happened to her. She isn't with her child, and no one hears from her, and she's a physical prisoner who's been injected and locked away, you know, like she's a criminal. All she has done is seen a crime committed, and they've locked her away, which means that we're all capable of being, you know, administered the same treatment at any moment. So because there's a woman involved, and because John Mitchell quietly slipped away, like the Washington Post had an article last night saying that Larry O'Brien came out and said it was perfectly obvious because of the links of the telephones and the connections of the people arrested at the Republican Committee that John Mitchell didn't resign because of his wife wanting him at home. Well, you know, the article goes into that at great length, you know. She wanted him to be in the Justice Department. She didn't mind his long hours. She just didn't want to be witness to a crime. And they also could go to jail for it if they harbored criminals, because one of the men arrested was employed by him. You see, so you've got all of these things happening. And then besides the woman's interest story, the suit pending, which Nixon knows will hurt it, and all of the press isn't for Nixon. If all of the press that's for McGovern publishes a part of this story, then the Nixon people will print it because it sells, not because they want to. They print a lot of good stuff on all these things, conspiracies and assassination, because they're there to make money. Besides, then, I mentioned before, if Life and Time are, and L.A. Times are actually afraid of Agnew, and I think he should be impeached and investigated, then why wouldn't they grab the story if the documentation is there? They've already said what they think about him, that he's a danger. They imply he's a danger to the country. He's dividing and so forth. So adding all those things up and given enough documentation, I think we'll get some action.
Well, we'll see. Okay, then we'll be moving on to an equally involved story concerning, Arthur Bremer.
Yeah,
there have been late developments in that.
You know, for weeks we were talking on these shows about Oswald and Ray and Sirhan and the other assassinations. And then when Wallace was shot, there was a lot of interest at the studio. Remember, people called up and they wanted to know what was happening, you know, with Wallace, and was it a political assassination. And remember, we did the show on Saturday. He was shot on Monday, and I gave all the reasons why I thought it was a conspiracy. And in the following week,
you also made a statement, if my memory serves me correct, which was fairly incredible at the time, but it seems a little bit more believable. And if my memory is right, you said that Arthur Bremer didn't shoot George Wallace.
Well, it sounded incredible to me.
And with the fact that it had been filmed by a CBS cameraman and had been witnessed by a crowd of people, and the fact that he had been captured immediately after the shooting, that seemed like an insane statement to make, but some testimony in the trial makes you wonder about that.
Well, you know, this is the same kind of thing after I'd been working on the John Kennedy murder for so many years, and then Sirhan killed Robert Kennedy, and there was certain evidence coming in on that, and then when I realized and mentioned the man who is suspected of shooting him, Thane Caesar, from the back of the head, and the autopsy said 1 inch from the back of the head, and I was communicating with my family in L.A., talking on the phone, and my mother said, she wrote me a letter, "May, now you really flip. You know, I mean, you've done the Oswald thing, but everyone knows that dirty little," and then she goes into all these ethnic expressions and criticisms of that little runch, you know, from that place, you know, way over there, and all, you know that he did it. And if everybody saw it, then you know, you are blowing your mind, because you're so much into conspiracies that you can't keep your head straight. Well, I brought in an article that was published this week on the destruction of the right arm of the coat of Robert Kennedy also. This is new material for me. The left shirt and coat sleeves and the cuffs links have been thrown away. They were cut off of his coat. And we'll go, I don't want to jump around too much, but the evidence on the tampering of Robert Kennedy's coat and the bullets and the guns and so forth, and the 10 bullets there, and Sirhan's gun only shot 8. I didn't say at the time that Bremer didn't shoot him. What I said was, and I said it right off the bat, because I can still add to 8, you know, and I'm lucky if I can do that these days. I said that there were 5 shots in Governor Wallace. The New York Times had pictures in the doctor's report. There were 5 shots that they admitted in Governor Wallace. Now it seems that there were many more. But there were 3 people at the shopping center that were also shot, a woman and a man and another guard who had 6-hour surgery. And it seems that 2 people were put in the hospital that day and just thrown out and played down, and nobody knew how bad they were hurt. But one of the women came to the trial. Yes, the one woman came. She's still on crutches and her leg in a cast, and she's in bad shape. So she obviously needed a lot of medical care, but they whisked her out of the hospital that day to not make a thing. But there were 3 people at the shopping center that were shot, and 5 bullets in Wallace, and nobody mentioned that the 3 people were directly behind Wallace, which was similar to the, like, there was a diversionary again, and like the Ambassador Hotel And Bramer yelled out something like, hey, where does he come by, or something like that, those effects. There was this diversionary. And there were 8 bullets, 3 people injured, you know, seriously, and Wallace had 5, and they weren't standing behind him, and it was a 5-gun revolver. Computer and Automation came out just this month with what I was adding up, you know, back in May at the time of the shooting. In July 1972, has an article on the shooting of presidential candidate George Wallace. And it goes into the New York Times article of the 5-bullet capacity of the gun that Bramer had. Then it goes into the bullets. 1 bullet passed through the upper arm and another through the right forearm. And 1 or both of 2 wounds in his chest could have been caused by bullets through the arm first. Well, it'd be hard to, you have to see where his arm would be, that he has 2 holes in the chest, and 1 in the right shoulder, 1 in the left shoulder. Then he had a bullet in his stomach, and that's the one that is causing all the trouble in drainage, because it broke his intestine and the waste matter got all inside of his stomach. We talked about the serious surgery he had. Then they couldn't do the bullet on the spine that lodged in his spine because the stomach surgery was so serious, and he had the shoulder and the 2 arm bullets. But the stomach one was really the serious one. And then the doctor's report came out May 17th talking about 2 superficial wounds in his back and another one in his abdominal cavity. Well, that added up to 8 inside of Mr. Wallace, and there were 3 more people. So Computer and Automation finds that they have 13 from 11 to 13 bullets. If his arm is over his chest, then they have 11 bullets. Otherwise, there's 13. So they said, what happened to the bullets? Nobody has connected the bullets to the gun that Bramer had. And we'll go into the removal of Bramer to the Maryland jail and how the prisoners objected to the special treatment he was getting. But we could jump right to the trial this week. Choosing the jury took 1 hour. You know,
it's pretty quick.
That took 1 hour. The prosecution met Tuesday. The prosecution was through in 1 day. But the prosecution was a bunch of psychiatrists who said he didn't know what he was doing. But then the defense went on, and Mr. Frazier, the same FBI man that did the ballistics work for the Warren Commission, it said, I'm reading a quotation from the newspaper, the defense had neither admitted or denied that it was Bramer who pulled the trigger of the gun that wounded Wallace, but widely published photographs showing him at the moment of the assault and afterwards being subdued. 2 FBI experts acknowledged that they had been unable to find Bramer's fingerprints on the gun, and this is exactly like all fingerprints on the gun, used in the shooting, and they were unable to trace the fired bullets to the gun and could not find powder residue on Bramer's hands. Now, sometimes I talk about Dallas in 1963, that there were no fingerprints of Oswald's on the gun. There was no paraffin on the test on his cheek or hands. It was negative. Oswald didn't fire a gun. And people say, well, how is that possible? You've got 26,000 exhibits and FBI experts. This is the same Frazier that said there was no fingerprints of Oswald's on the gun who's saying it here. And he's having a trial. The prosecution ended yesterday. Now they're on the defense. They chose the jury in 1 hour. If this isn't a railroaded thing when they had suspects changing license plates. For those of you who didn't hear the earlier shows, there was a suspect in Maryland that was changing his license plates. He weighed 220 pounds, 6'2", heavy set, dark fellow. A man up in Michigan, Milwaukee Ferry, saw Bramer with 2 other men. 1 was 220 pounds, 225 pounds, 6'2", dark complected. Bramer checked in at the Waldorf Astoria. There was no discussion what floor he stayed on, who he stayed with, the Lord Elgin Hotel. I have information he stayed at the same floor as a CIA agent. In L.A., they have his name. They want to stay at the Lord Elgin Hotel. He's with the CIA agent up in Canada when he was up there. Now, this goes into the problem, again, which I mentioned in the article 2 or 3 times, I think, that Patrick Gray III has not been appointed head of the FBI, and he should be removed from any nomination or from any office in the Justice Department. His first case after J. Edgar Hoover was killed was, and this was to consolidate the CIA to take care of the Justice Department, his first case was the Brammer case. And the second big case is the Watergate. Well, if the FBI found no fingerprints of Brammer's on the gun, and they had no bullet tracings, no bullets to prove, they didn't even find a bullet to prove that it matched the gun, and no tests on Brammer, then why did the FBI close the case?
Okay, well, let's answer that question, or at least bring it up again after we identify the station and the program. This is Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel. You're listening to it on KLRB FM Carmel, 24 hours.